University of Pennsylvania and former chair, U.S. Commission on Civil Rights, on Monday, April 4th at 4 p.m. on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
And good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning, Jason Croft. In this part of Focus 580, we will be taking your questions. And our guest for the show is Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist here at the U of I, and probably for quite a few years now. He has been stopping by, particularly when it's been warm, to answer questions about dealing with household insect pests. So if you got some kind of problem, it can be in the house, it can be out in the yard. If you call in, give us a description, tell us what it is, what it looks like. He will suggest how to take care of it. And all you got to do is dial those numbers. The numbers are, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So locally, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We'll take as many questions as we possibly can, and I know Phil will do his best to help you out. Thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Some things, now, this is maybe a little bit early, but I thought, well, chances are we probably have some people who have ants, maybe other sorts of things in the house. Is there anything in particular outside, though, that right now you'd say this would be a good time to work on a particular problem?
Well, if you've got scale insects that are on plants, such as Euonymus scale, which will be white eighth inch flecks on the leaves and on the stems, or pine needle, pine needle scale, it looks the same but isn't controllable with at this time of year, or cottony maple scale or Lycanium scale, look like little brown army helmets about an eighth of an inch across on the stems. These are all susceptible to dormant oil sprays, and dormant oil sprays are probably most effective right about now in the spring of the year before the leaves start to come onto the trees. The oil is a petroleum, light petroleum oil that covers and suffocates the scale and keeps it from breathing. And as we're getting into warmer weather and as fluids are starting to move inside the tree, the scale, who are sucking insects and have their mouth parts deep inside, they're realizing this change and they're starting to gear up and they're breathing more times a minute right now. And so a dormant oil spray, which is meant to suffocate, will kill them much quicker and much better at this time of year. We recommend an application before the leaves start to come onto the trees when the temperature is going to stay above freezing for 24 hours after application. And if you've got an evergreen euonymus, you just look at the other trees around, and when they start to leaf, that's when the dormant time is over for the euonymus as well.
Mm-hmm. Scale, I think, is one of those things that people might confuse people because they don't look like insects.
No,
they don't look like they should be alive.
They can totally confuse entomologists. I'm into bonsai, and I actually had a plant one time for several years ago. I thought it had this really nice looking bark until I started noticing it going peaked and getting some honeydew sticky material on and started looking closer. And a really neat bark was scales on top of each other. So it can blow people away that know what scale look like. But they start out with legs, antennae, eyes, and so on. And as they settle down to feed, they lose those and just essentially become literally a bump on a log. And with really nothing characteristic on the outside except it's a bump is not supposed to be there. And most kind of bumps or markings that are on branches of trees and shrubs are going to have some sort of a pattern to them. If what you're seeing doesn't have a pattern, tends to be grouped more in one area and that's not repeated in other similar areas on a tree, chances are you're looking at scale.
All right. Well, we got a couple callers here. Let's go to line number one and Urbana right here. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I have kind of a strange question. This isn't so much of how to kill a pest, but how to keep it out of my house so that I don't have to kill it. I have so many ladybugs that have been invading my home, and once they're inside, they die. And so I have dead ladybugs everywhere. And this is always this is a symbolic insect for me, something that's always been considered a good luck charm. So how do I keep the ladybugs from wanting to invade my apartment?
Well, what you have probably is the multicolored Asian lady beetle. It's a little over an eighth of an inch in diameter, probably close to a quarter. and has 19 black spots on the back, and they vary in color from kind of a yellow to an orange to a reddish. And sometimes the spots are small, sometimes so small that there's not 19 or there's no spots at all. But they will come in to the house late in the season, attracted to sunny areas such as the south and west sides of buildings. And if they're sunlit, they will come to them. There are, we recommend caulking cracks and crevices around the windows and around the foundation and so on to keep them from getting in, particularly at edges where the eave, edge of the eave or the corner of a house, outside or inside corners. These sorts of areas are where they tend to accumulate.
Yeah,
there
it's amazing
are,
how they get in even when the windows are shut.
Yeah, they can find cracks and crevices. They spend the winter inside the house, and when they get warm, they come in to the inside of a house, and we recommend vacuuming them up there, or you can use, they sell little light traps that will attract the ladybugs inside the house. These are available now primarily on the Internet is where I found them.
Yeah.
But those will help reduce them. There are, if you wanted to use an insecticide, there are pest control companies can spray for these in the fall and stop them. Long-term answer is planting trees to shade the south and west sides of your house. And I know that's a long-term thing. You know, it's maybe 10 years before you have that. But you never get it until you start getting that shade. So that will make a huge difference on the mountain ladybugs.
But what makes them want to come in when they die once they're inside? I mean, that doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, the vast majority of them do not die when they're inside. The vast majority of them stay inside the wall of your house where it stays cool. And then as it warms up over the next month or two, they will go back outside. Although you're feeling like you're seeing everyone that could possibly be there, you're probably seeing 1 in 10 or something
wow.
like that's inside the house. It would not be surprising to me that a house that has a you know an older farmhouse type building, you know, that tends to not be as tight as some others. It wouldn't surprise me that the numbers of beetles inside the walls would approach several hundred thousand in the wintertime.
Oh my gosh, that's incredible.
So, and on the other side of this, they do go out and they do feed on soybean aphids and help reduce that problem for the farmer. So,
they have
their good points. They do feed on aphids on trees and shrubs and so on.
Yeah.
But they are a new insect, and if you didn't notice it 5 or 6 years ago, there's a good reason it wasn't here then.
Okay, well, thanks very much for the information. I appreciate it.
All right, very good.
Welcome.
Let's go on to someone here on a cell phone, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, I have a question about, I have potted herbs inside my house that I use for cooking.
Mm-hmm.
And the mint got infested with spider mites, and I'm wondering how, if there's a way to get rid of them without poisoning the people who eat the food.
Okay. Usually, what we would recommend there would be spraying them with an insecticidal soap,
okay.
And this will be sold in garden centers as insecticidal soap. It's very similar to the soap that's on your counter, and but the difference is that it's been formulated to not be damaging to the plant leaves,
okay.
And that can be sprayed on, and because it is a soap. If you harvest the leaves off of it, just washing it well in clear water should remove the soap residue. And the worst you're going to have is a little bit of indigestion from it, some gut problems. But it should be able to wash that off quite well before you use any part of the herb.
Okay, but it does take care of spider mites?
Yes, it does. We would recommend application once a week for 2 or 3 weeks.
Okay. I didn't know it was so simple. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. And to line number 3, this is someone in Champaign. Hello.
Yes. I have a redbud tree about 8 to 9, 10 feet in front of my house. And in the recent storm that took down, you know, with all the ice, took down one of the limbs, we realized that there were a bunch of ants, basically some form of termite, I think, that were just infesting the limb there. And so just a couple of questions. One is, do I have to worry about them, given that there's a walkway of about 8 or 9 feet across in front of the house, coming into the house underneath the ground or something? You know, I'm just worried about that. And also, in terms of the fallen wood, I have a lot of wood, and I'm always worried, even if it's other wood, that I'll come in and burn it, and there'll be like termites or something in it. And so is there some way to know or to deal with that issue as well when you're burning wood for in the fireplace and so on?
Okay. Were the insects that you saw white, or were they dark-colored?
They were dark.
Okay, these would have been ants, probably carpenter ants. Mm-hmm. Carpenter ants are going to be normally fairly large ants, though typically the workers are about a quarter of an inch long.
Right.
And they will live inside, inside wood, particularly preferring damp or rotted wood to hollow out, and probably your redbud, because the branch broke off, probably had some wood rot in there that these ants took advantage of and cleared out part of that non-structural wood. It had rotted to where it was no longer structurally useful. And so they did not increase the problem. They were just taking advantage of a situation. They normally are not going to be a problem inside the house unless you have damp wood in the house. And so the prevention there is to take care of any leaky eave areas or water drain pipes as soon as you know about it, rather than, well, let's wait a few months, that sort of thing. Because that damp wood will be attractive to carpenter ants during the warmer times of the year. Generally, with wood that you use for firewood, whether you buy it for firewood or anything else, you should assume that it has insects in it, because dead wood, even if it was cut alive, by the time you're going to put it in the fireplace, it's going to have been dead for a while and will attract insects to it. Lots of borers, carpenter ants, other sorts of things that I get calls about, what they call strange crawly things or flying things around the house, and it commonly comes in on firewood. Our recommendation is you don't bring in a piece of firewood until you're ready to put it on the fire. The idea of having a few pieces of wood next to the fireplace may look nice, but it's a great way to introduce insects into your home. And store the firewood so it's not against your house, so that anything can't go out of the wood in the firewood and into the wood of your house. And just bring it in when you're ready to put it on the fire. And it will typically use the firewood when it's cold outside, so by the time they warm up, they're kind of frying in there, so
right.
It's not a big deal that way.
Yeah, and as far as the ants go, I mean, are there some black ants or carpenter ants that have wings? I saw a couple when I was looking at the wood, and that made me a little nervous. Is that normal for there to be a few?
Well, pretty much all ants will reproduce by producing winged individuals, and some winged individuals with carpenter ants indicates a nest has probably been there for about 5 years. It usually has to be there that long before they produce wings. But this is the dispersal stage of the insect, and carpenter ants are so common in our residential areas that it's not that you try to get rid of a carpenter ant, you try to protect your house from them.
Right.
And the amount of damage they would do if they got in the house would be minimal anyway.
Oh, really? Okay. And if there were termites, what color would they be then? Can they be light brown? Or just
if you found termites that were active inside wood like that, you would be finding wingless white insects about an eighth of an inch long. They do produce winged individuals that are dark-colored and look somewhat superficially like flying ants, but they don't have a pinched-in waist that an ant has. Those occur in the late winter, early spring, but they're not, they're out flying around as well. And the fact that you live in Illinois indicates that there are flying termites around at various times of the year, just like there would be carpenter ants. So
Right. Okay. It's,
again, it's not a case that you worry about them if you just kind of protect your house and obviously if you would find termites, which would look like little white ant-like creatures inside wood, then you might want to consider about maybe getting your house inspected or something like that if it's very close to the house. But other than that,
is there any place at the university you can take like an example of one just to make sure, just for future reference?
Yes, you can take that to your local extension office. And they will be able to identify it on the spot. And if they don't, they have a system where they can photograph the insect and then. And then send it via email to an expert. If they can't identify it, then they send it to me. So
okay, well,
the buck stops with me on that system.
Right. Well, thank you.
If I don't know, they're in a heap of trouble.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. The guest this morning here in this hour of Focus 580 is extension entomologist Phil Nixon from the U of I. Occasionally, he's here on the program, and we give you an opportunity to call in with insect pest questions. And if you have some problem, call and tell us about it, and Phil will see if he can help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone here on our toll-free line in Aurora, line number 4. Hello.
So then talk getting back to termites. There's nothing new to do for them, or is there?
Well, with termites, there are. There have always been, for many years, there has been, if you have termites, there have been barrier treatments that used to use chlordane, and then that was taken off the market in 1987. And there's been a variety of materials that have been less effective since then. About 4 or 5 years ago, there came upon the market two products that became available in the last few years. One is called imidacloprid, which is sold as Premise, and the other one is fipronil, which is sold as Termidor. These materials will give about 10 years of control as a prevention around the foundation. It's not 35 like chlordane gave, but it's a lot better than some of the other materials in between. We also have baiting systems, of which the most popular and most successful are Centricon and Xterra. Both of these systems use hormone-like materials, insecticides that mimic hormones, to be carried back to a colony and kill off the colony, generating the termite attack of a house. But still, protecting your house from termites involves, taking care of damp wood situations, making sure you've got a good several inches of foundation showing that you don't take the wood right down to the house, down to the ground, that you don't have on the siding, that you don't have firewood stacked against the house, that you try to keep the area around your house well drained, because termites are highly attracted to moisture, and that you reduce the amount of wood soil contacts that you have.
So you really shouldn't have plantings close to the house.
Plantings close to the house are fine. You got to realize the termites attack dead wood, not live wood.
Oh, okay.
So, but still, just so that your house is. So that you don't have damage to your siding, you don't want to have trees or shrubs that are brushing the house either.
The other thing I wanted to ask was, I don't know if you take care of anything like slugs, which is an outside.
Sure, uh-huh.
And I wondered when you start fighting slugs.
Well, the best way to help reduce slugs is to reduce the two things they need the most, dead organic matter and moisture. And a lot of people that have slugs, such as in hosta beds and things of this nature, make this heavy mass planting of plants and then mulch it heavily around it. And that's everything you could possibly do to increase your slug population. If you space the plants out so you get some air movement between them, don't mulch quite so heavily, allow that soil to dry out in between rainfalls, that will greatly reduce the slug problem on its own without doing anything else. And then slugs will start feeding relatively early. I would assume that they will start causing damage within the next month or so. And if you do need to use a bait, probably some of the iron phosphate baits are going to be the best. They're sold under the brand name of Sluggo.
Sluggo?
S-L-U-G-G-O, or Escargo is also a brand name of this. But they are... But primarily, we recommend controlling slugs by spacing out plants. It means you have to pull a few weeds, and reducing mulches, which also means you have to pull a few weeds. But you either have a weeds or that you have to pull, or you have the slugs which eat your plants. You kind of have your choice.
Thank you much.
All uh-huh. right, thanks for the call. Just for a second to go back to the multicolor Asian lady beetle,
uh-huh.
because as you say, I think people will say that they've been seeing numbers of these insects in the last couple of years, particularly maybe late in the summer, you start right. to see them, and they can hang around in the house all the way up until the end of the year sometimes, mm-hmm. and then you don't see them again, but then in the springtime, maybe you start to see them. As it gets warmer again, you start to see them. These, they weren't around. If we go back enough years, we did not have them. Where did they come from?
Actually, they were brought in to help control aphids on pecan trees, and this was done primarily in the late 80s, early 90s, and that time span. Most of them were released in Georgia, where pecans are big, mm-hmm. and these were imported from China at the time when you could only get say, a two-week visa or something like this in communist China, they were able to find that these were effective in controlling aphids on trees and particularly on these types of aphids. And they brought them in without really probably being there and having some language barriers such that to understand that that there was a problem with when they become adult and look for a place to overwinter. And they have several generations through the summer, but when they get into the fall of the year, they migrate to primarily cliff faces and overwinter in the cracks and crevices and in the faces of cliffs. But they also have adapted to doing that in houses, and they do that in China, except that apparently the people involved with bringing these in were not able to ascertain that before they were brought in. And so they have spread much very rapidly, and we saw them come into the state several years ago in the Effingham area, which southeastern part of the state, coming up from Georgia, went across most of the state the next year, and finally ended up getting into the northwestern part of the state into Iowa the third year. So they came across the state very quickly. I've noticed a tremendous reduction in the number of calls that I get associated with aphids and even scale insects. They do a number on those, but they're definitely something that was brought in that should not have been brought in because of the problems that they've caused. And as a result of this, some of the regulations and requirements have gotten much stiffer. These were brought in by some USDA scientists, and they used to be pretty well exempt from all of the other hoops and hurdles that the rest of us had to bring in things. Now they have to go through all those hoops and hurdles partly because of this insect.
Okay. Well, let's talk with some more folks here. Next in line is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello there.
Mm-hmm.
I found a silverfish on the wall of my house yesterday, and I do have a basement that I have a dehumidifier running, and just need to know a little bit more about them and how I get rid of them.
Okay, well, silverfish are quarter inch long or so, and they can be lighter or fairly dark colored and with three tails on the back end, long antennae in the front. They're primarily nocturnal, coming out at night, and they feed primarily on molds and mildews. They can feed on starchy material, sometimes can chew on carpeting. In years ago, they used to eat the wallpaper paste, but now we use different types of glues on wallpaper, so that's not a problem anymore. They primarily need moist conditions, and usually silverfish are going to be present in the most humid room in the house, which is usually the bathroom. And anything you can do to reduce humidity there will greatly reduce the silverfish problem. Making sure you're using an exhaust fan after showers, maybe leaving the door stand open when the room is not in use. These sorts of things will help reduce the humidity in that room and elsewhere in the house. Now, in recent years, we've had some situations where with people building these energy-efficient houses that are very, very tight and maintain high humidities, we end up getting silverfish problems that are essentially uncontrollable unless the humidity is reduced. People have been under the assumption that more humidity is better, and so they run a humidity that's over 50% year-round in their house. Under those conditions, silverfish cannot be controlled. You have to reduce that humidity in order to get it down, as well as some molds and mildews become out of control. So too much humidity can be a bad thing, and they need to keep that in mind. If you've got a fairly new house, that may be part of your problem. You may have a humidifier running on your furnace all the time that is keeping the humidity higher than perhaps it should be.
Well, I have an older home, and it seemed awfully early in the season, I guess, for a high humidity level. It does feel damp in the basement, which is why I run the dehumidifier.
Yeah, that's a good thing to do, running the dehumidifier in the basement. The other thing you need to be watchful, if you have that kind of a home, is to see if you've got some sort of a moisture leak. Maybe you've got a roof leak or a water drain pipe leak inside a wall, particularly that's near that area. We get them sometimes because of leaky shower stalls, variety of things that way. We've had them in kitchens due to leaky hookups to dishwashers. So watch if you've got, with the kind of house you describe, and particularly the time of year, I agree, this is not the time when you would normally expect to see silverfish. So in a house that runs a fairly low humidity. So I would be watchful for any type of water leak that you may have, roof leak, water drain pipe leak, maybe doing some inspection in the basement, in the attic, some areas there, seeing if you've got some damp, darker wood somewhere that might be indicative of a leak.
And is there any type of spraying, or if I just get rid of the moisture problem, the humidity, they should go away?
Getting rid of the humidity will make them go away, but you can also help control them with aerosol ant and roach spray sprayed in cracks and crevices such as baseboards.
Okay, great. All right, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, let's go next talk somebody in Charleston. This is line number two. Hello.
Hello, thank you very much. Mm-hmm. We live in a house that has about, a 50 to 75-foot band of grass around it, and beyond that, in almost all directions, is, basically forest. And I was wondering if that kind of location has any relationship to the likelihood of termite infestations in a house. Is what kind of wood do they prefer, and where would they be likely to go?
Absolutely. if you think about it, evolutionarily, termites did not evolve to feed on houses because houses weren't around then. They evolved to be a forest insect and to help get rid of the dead trees that were out there. And so anytime you're near forest area or your house is on forest soils and might still have decaying wood materials in it, you are highly susceptible to termites compared to other people, much more so than normally. Best, and they also like damp soils, so having good drainage will help reduce that problem. But certainly, a location that is surrounded by forested area is going to be more likely to have termites than probably pretty much anywhere else that you're going to be able to locate.
Okay, I was thinking it might be, since we're close, that they would prefer to stay out there in the natural treed area and stay away from the house. But apparently that doesn't work that way.
Well, they will prefer to stay out there, but population expansion, as they would have it, would make it such that there will always be winged termites probably flying around in the vicinity of your house, and if they find the right opportunity, they will take advantage of it. They can also move from their underground tunnels as much as a quarter of a mile to find a food source, and your 50 to 75 feet is not a barrier hardly at all from a colony that's out in the soil in the forested area. So those are all factors. If they do attack the house, you will find them in the hardwoods first. This was normally going to be window framing, door framings, this sort of thing. They really don't like softwoods because the resins in the wood are essentially anti-termite feedings.
Okay.
So they will many times build tunnels or tubes across those and to get into the hardwood in the house. They will feed on this other as well. They also have a curious habit. They go after anything cellulose, and the curious habit they have is many times they'll eat the cardboard facing off of drywall. And so you'll notice on the side of a wall on the inside of the house a meandering line that tends to be a different color, and that's because the termites are in there eating the cardboard facing, and the humidity that they bring into their tunnels will cause the paint to bubble and discolor right over that spot.
Okay, I'm trying to keep an eye on places where, well, basically any place inside the house where I thought they might see evidence of tunneling. Haven't seen any, but next question is, how often is retreatment necessary? We had it done once in the building process of the house. It's been about 14 years ago now.
It depends what was being used. At that time, at that time's period, chances are it was treated with chlorpyrifos, which had been sold as Dursban TC. That material is probably good for 6, maybe 10 years maximum. And so that means that treatment is no longer effective. However, that doesn't mean that you necessarily need to immediately retreat. Checking for termites yourself or having a termite company come out and do an inspection, which they will commonly do for free because they hope to get your business, is a good way to pick up on termites. It's very rare that termites do any significant damage in the span of a year, so in any less than a year. So termite inspections in your location once a year, and termite inspections in other areas every 3 to 5 years are probably a good idea.
Is there anything in terms of treatment that it would be possible to either recommend or avoid?
Generally, the products that are the top of the in my opinion, that are available out there now, are the barrier treatments using Premis or Termidor. And for bait applications, which are also effective, either the Centricon or Xterra system. And these are all available through your local pest control companies.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the information. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thanks for the call. Of those two methods, as they work differently, one where you're essentially putting the insecticide in the soil all the way around the house, the other one using these bait stations where what they do is they put these stations around. They put a piece of wood in there first, and then they come back periodically and check it. And then if there's evidence the termites have gone after that piece of wood, then
they put the bait in.
They put the bait in. And these there can be, I think, fairly significant difference in the cost of the two methods. Do you think or that one or the other is better, or do you just stay away from saying, yes, I would recommend one or the other method?
Well, neither are perfect. A lot of it, the difference in cost is – is considerable but not overwhelming, I guess is a way to put it. Probably for the standard, whatever that is, house, a barrier treatment where they put the insecticide in the soil around the foundation is going to cost somewhere around $1,600, $1,700 for a treatment, which should be good with the materials I mentioned for about 10 years. So that's, you know, you prorates out not all that much. The bait systems are normally going to be $1,700 to $2,000, maybe $2,200, so significantly more, but not overwhelmingly so. And those are effective only as long as they're in place. And when you pull up the bait stations, you have absolutely no protection. And there is a fee for monitoring those stations, which is usually several hundred dollars a year. There is commonly a fee to come out and make sure that your barrier treatment is fine, of probably less money, probably a couple hundred dollars there versus $300 or $400 on the bait stations, because there's labor involved going out and checking those stations every month. So a lot of it becomes a case of personal preference more than anything else, in my opinion. If you're a type of person that has a general problem with the idea of them putting insecticide all the way around your house, and you would rather use as small amount of insecticide as possible, then probably the bait station is the way to go. A lot of very heavily environmentally minded people will tend to go that direction. On the other hand, if you're looking for, I want it done as inexpensive, I want it put in once, and I don't want to have to worry about it, barrier treatment is probably more thing, and neither is worse than the other, really. The barrier treatments are low solubility material, so they really don't move into groundwaters and so on. They stay right there next to the foundation. So there's a variety of things. The gentleman that just called with a forested area around him, obviously there's in a situation where you have a forest around a house, there is an probably inexhaustible supply of termite colonies continually running through that soil that would go into the bait stations, and he would be looking at a very expensive proposition over a very long period of time to maintain stations around his home, because he could probably never be in a situation where he just doesn't have them anymore, perhaps. Whereas there, the barrier would probably be a better option. On the other hand, somebody who has, say, a rubble foundation, which would allow insecticide fumes to come in through the foundation, perhaps from a barrier treatment, or somebody who has a well that's underneath a house or right against a foundation, which causes problems in barrier treatment, then a bait situation is best. But generally, for most people, it comes out to just what is more attractive to you as far as the ideal and how they're doing it.
Okay. Well, we're a bit past the midpoint here. Phil Nixon is our guest. He's an extension entomologist at U of I, and we're talking about dealing with household insect pests. Can be in the house, can be in the yard, or in the home landscape. If you have a question, you can call us, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next caller is in Indiana. Line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Here is my wife. She knows what's going on.
Okay. Hello.
Yes, ma'am.
We have an ornamental cherry tree out here, and I checked it this spring, and it's got like round growths on it that look. Yeah.
They're real gray.
They're gray, and they're kind of bumpy.
They're sticking out from a trunk?
Yes.
Okay. These are probably decay fungi, bracket fungi probably is what it is. I would guess that for this to be on your cherry tree, you're looking at a cherry tree which is in the teens, if not older, in age?
No. Yeah.
It's about 12 years old.
Okay. Many cherry trees are many trees that are in this group. Cherries and plums are very short-lived trees, and what you're seeing on the outside is probably evidence of wood rot inside the trunk. Your tree may survive for several years, but you probably need to think about a replacement tree. Really not anything feasible that you can do to stop this process. As a tree gets older, it will get some wood rot in the center, and this is the fungus actually reproducing or putting out spores to the outside through this Brachus fungus, and really you have to realize that these types of trees are not real long lived. You also want to make sure that tree's not large enough and close enough to something that should it fall that it's going to be a problem. If it is, you may want to have an arborist, a tree expert, out to look at it and to see if it should be taken down due to it being weak. It's an indication you've got an inside of a tree trunk is rotted, and thus it's not near as stable as it was before.
Is that right? Now, I noticed we've got it on two other trees. Like, one of them is a flowering pear tree.
Uh-huh.
It's not as bad as on this ornamental cherry.
Uh-huh. You're still looking at a very close related tree, a tree that's in essentially the same it's not
category?
Same family, and again a relatively short-lived tree. One of probably would get these sorts of things after 10, 15, 20 years, something like this. They can live for a number of years with this on them and still produce flowers or fruit or whatever the case may be. With that, you just need to realize that the tree's in its twilight years, should we say, probably not going to live all that much longer. And if you really like that kind of a tree in your landscape, you start a new one somewhere else that's where you'd like to have it, because probably within 5 years this tree will be no more.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Right. Very good. Thanks for the call. We'll continue here, and next we will talk with somebody in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Mm-hmm.
Back to lady beetles.
Uh-huh.
You know, I remember lady beetles forever.
Yes.
You know, we've had them. You know, they used to be smaller.
Well, we still have them.
Yeah. In fact, one thing that they seem to have disappeared for a while, but this spring I've noticed a few of the smaller ones.
I believe there's something like 300 different kinds of lady beetles in North America, and best I can tell, we have not lost any of our native lady beetles with the introduction of this other lady beetle. Primarily, I think, because this is primarily a tree-living lady beetle, and this being a prairie area, most of Illinois, we don't have much in the way of lady beetles native that feed in the trees. So it tends to hit what we call an open niche, an unused niche, and thus is not crowding out, apparently, the other lady beetles or anything, or it's not obvious that that's happening. It may be happening, we're not noticing it.
Okay, thanks.
Uh-huh.
All right, and let's see. We'll go to next caller, and this is our line number four in Bloomington, Illinois, on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Yeah.
I don't know if this has been covered. I tuned in a little bit late. I don't know if it's the lady beetle is the same thing, but every season, without fail, my wife and I find they look like ladybugs, but they're a little bit dustier colored, and they seem to hang out near light fixtures a lot. And I was curious, I don't know if you've already covered that or not, but they don't really seem to get into anything, but they seem to love the ceiling in our kitchen because we have a lot of we have some recessed lighting in there.
Yes, and this would be the multicolored Asian lady beetle, and we have talked about it already. Essentially, caulking cracks and crevices around the outside, on the outside around the windows and around foundation areas along edges and corners of the house will help keep them from getting in. You can use vacuum them up inside and dump the vacuum cleaner bag outside. There are light traps that you can purchase that you can use inside the house. If there's no other lights on, it will attract them to them. But this is a new lady beetle that's gotten in the last 10 years or less, and is becomes very numerous and somewhat of a nuisance being inside the house. But like you say, they don't reproduce inside the house. They don't really cause any damage. They will bite people if they land on them occasionally, but normally don't break the skin. They are kind of a nuisance though, and vacuum them up, caulking around the windows particularly will help reduce them.
Is there any reason at all to have an exterminator come in to spray to eliminate them, or is it really just a matter of keeping them out barrier-wise?
Just keep them out barrier-wise. Pest control companies, exterminators, can come out in the fall and do a spray on the outside of a house, particularly around the eaves and edges and corners, and keep them out with one spray for the year. And that's going to be attractive to some people. But interior applications from a pest control company will only give you very short-lived results. They don't really pick up the dried insecticide through their legs very well. And so you're probably not going to be very satisfied with any interior applications.
And there's really no point in doing an exterior application with an exterminator at this point in the season?
Not at this point in the season. This would be done in the fall of the year when they're coming in and attracted to the house. Probably late August, early September, that sort of thing.
Right, and we have a light-colored house, and some of our neighbors say that they do prefer lighter-colored houses versus darker-colored houses.
Yeah,
for some reason.
They are attracted to sunlit outside walls, and the lighter-colored, the better. As I mentioned earlier, one long-term answer is planting trees on the south and west sides of the house to eventually shade those sides. That will almost reduce them in themselves.
Okay,
almost
great.
Eliminate them for you.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay,
you're welcome.
Very good. Let's go to line number two, an Urbana caller. Hello.
Line two?
Yes.
Hi. Two questions. One, is now the time for dormant oil spray on your apple trees, or is that a little later?
On your apple trees, many times people do an application at what we call a half-inch green stage, which is when the leaves are out, the buds in opening buds are out about a half an inch, and you're showing now about a half an inch of green leaves sticking out. This is probably the best time for that, although applying at this time of year should be very, very good. Normally, for homeowners, dormant spray may not be all that needed. You're primarily trying to control San Jose scale, which will make little red spots on the lower side of the apples that cause some dieback there, and also rosy apple aphids that, with the lady beetles around, aren't much of a problem. And both of these, the rosy apple aphids and other apple aphids, and the San Jose scale, are primarily a function of a lot of insecticide sprays that kill off the natural enemies so that these build up. And for most homeowners don't apply insecticides often enough to do this. This is primarily a commercial orchard problem where they have to, in order to make ends meet, they have to have a very high percentage of their apples being perfect so the public will buy them. Most homeowners don't spray that often. They put up with a little bit of damage to their apples, and they're just fine with it. So it's been my experience that most homeowners don't really need to apply a dormant spray for apples.
Okay. The other question is, what do you think about wood chips around the foundation of a house?
I think wood chips or any other type of mulch or fallen leaves, dead organic matter that is rotting alongside the outside foundation of your house, is going to be very attractive to a lot of the things that like to come into your house that will either feed on that wood material, that decaying material, or feed on something that feeds on that decaying material. And so reducing the amount of dead organic matter, including wood chips or mulch of any type, next to the foundation should reduce the number of spiders, crickets, centipedes, millipedes, earwigs, various other types of creatures that would come in through that foundation just because you're feeding them or feeding their food next to the foundation, and that puts them right in close proximity to your house.
Well,
I think
right.
Mulching is great around from the out once you get away from a house, but right against the foundation, you are asking for invading pests.
Yeah. Termites included?
Termites normally not, unless the mulch is thick enough that it stays wet at the bottom and never dries out.
Yeah.
So we don't recommend putting mulch that's and wood chips that are any deeper than, say, 2 to 3 inches, and preferably 1 to 2 inches deep next to the foundation, so that dries out in between rains and this is not a rotting wood thing that will attract termites from short range.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right.
Bye.
Next, we have somebody all the way up in Kenosha, Wisconsin, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I wonder if you could help me. I recently took a trip down to Texas and through the South, and I came back and discovered, the evening I came back, I discovered I brought something along Okay, it's either a large spider or a large scorpion, because I saw it kind of in the half light, and it was very, very fast. Now I'm wondering, how do I get rid of this critter? One thing it does is it seems to have a little click to it, which I've heard at various times through the course of an evening. You know, toward the middle of the night, and it's kind of a noisy little critter, because, like I say, I can hear him walking across paper and all these things. But in the process of this, it's kind of annoying. Everybody says not to worry about it, but, you know, I've seen him now about 3 or 4 times kind of in a half light, so I have not gotten a really good look at it. I tried the water route where I made sure that it wasn't able to have water, and what I did was I put down the glue paper and tried that, and I'm having a difficult time trying to get this little guy to leave. You know?
Okay, it could be what you're describing could be spiders, or it could be scorpions or house centipedes. Everything but the scorpion would occur here anyway. Uh-huh. But normally, for control of any of those, an aerosol ant and roach spray in cracks and crevices in the areas where you feel that they're located should eliminate them. That'll last for about a month, and in that period of time, they'll get into it, and that should work great. You know, along baseboards, other cracks and crevices should be effective.
Well, that would be like reed or something on that.
Yes, as long as it says it's for ants and roaches, that should work great for you.
Well, this is quite large, though. I mean,
I realize that, but when you get what I'm talking about is this type of spray that's going to be in an ant and roach spray will control these other types of creatures for you, or it should.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, good luck.
Bye.
We have maybe about 5 minutes, maybe a little bit less, if somebody wants to call in, talk with our guest, Phil Nixon. He's an extension entomologist at U of I, and if you have problems with insect pests in the home, inside, out in the yard, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of the things that you said that maybe we should just mention to people is bagworms. If you, if you got them, if you know they're out there, go and get them.
Yeah, bagworms have been something that's been fairly heavy the last 2 or 3 years. They run in cycles because we're looking at a native insect that has its own natural enemies and will build up for about 3 years and then drop down and not be as numerous for 5 or 6. And they will tend to attack the tops of trees such as arborvitae, eastern red cedar, other junipers, eastern white pine, etc. And you get these spindle-shaped bags that are about 1.5 inches long, 1.25 inches, 1.5 inches. And they'll be brown right now and hanging on the trees. And inside every other bag, on average, is 300 to 1,000 eggs, which will be hatching around the middle part of June. And a good thing to do when you've got nice days like today and tomorrow, and it's just you want to get out and do something, and it's really too wet to garden, go out and pick your bagworms and throw them into a plastic bag or something else. Don't drop them underneath a tree. They'll hatch there too. And throw them in the trash. And every other bag you pick off, you just eliminated 300 to 1,000 kids. You need to get to the top of a tree in order to be very successful. But even if you can't get to the top, at least removing some of the bags is going to be helpful. And so it's a good late winter, early spring activity that gives you something to do.
Okay. At what point would you expect we'd start to see mosquitoes?
Mosquitoes are going to start showing up anytime we have several days where it stays, when it gets up fairly warm. I would not be surprised if some of the listeners out there got bit yesterday. There are mosquitoes that will overwinter as adults, and anytime you get temperatures up into the middle to high 50s, they will come out and be active. And they're primarily in forested areas, the ones that overwinter, the eastern treehorn mosquito, and some other mosquitoes will do this as well. Other treehorn mosquitoes will do this as well. And they will come out and bite on a nice day. So you won't really see large numbers of mosquitoes until we get warmer temperatures that stay well above 50 or 60, and a lot of spring rains and some water standing. Then we get to floodwater mosquitoes coming in, and that's normally the second half of April, early part of May.
Okay. We got somebody else here, someone to talk to in Wapella on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I'm calling about spiders inside the house mostly, and I'm wondering, this is, I guess, more of a philosophical question, do we really need to worry about them? I mean, is there a danger, or is it just people who just give or get the creeps when spiders are around, get rid of them? I mean, do we really need to get rid of them?
Well, a lot of that depends on how you're made up genetically, and the reason I say that is that some of the larger spiders, such as wolf spiders, which will have a leg span of about 2 inches, inch and a half, 2 inches, and the yellow house spiders, which are little light-colored spiders with about an inch leg span that will crawl across the wall and ceilings, and then jumping spiders, which are little fuzzy, black, short-legged spiders which run in little short jerks. These have all been associated with brown recluse-type bites, a sore that will get up the size of a nickel to a quarter and doesn't heal, scabs and sloughs. But this happens primarily if you genetically you are very susceptible to them. Most people are not going to react that way. These spiders will come into, if you turn your thermostat down at night in the wintertime, they'll be out running around at night, and they will go to the warm spot, which is underneath the covers. You roll over onto them, they bite in self-defense. This can be a problem with them. But if you have not had problems with spider bites in the past, generally they're just helping keep down the other critters that are in your house and probably not going to cause any real harm.
Would a person who is naturally susceptible to bee stings perhaps be more likely to be affected by spider bites?
My understanding is this is a different type of venom, and okay. So they really don't have anything in common between bee or wasp stings versus spider bites.
I see. Well, very interesting. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Right. Well, thank you. Well, I guess at about that, we will wrap it up for this time around with a promise that I'm sure that maybe in a few weeks, Phil will come back and we can talk some more. And I expect we'll get even more questions because the bugs will be more active at that point.
The warmer it gets, the more there are.
Yeah, well, thank you very much.
Glad to be here.
Appreciate it. Phil Nixon, he's an extension entomologist here at University of Illinois. Programs here on AM 580 are made possible by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. The broadcast today is also made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. Well, that's it for us, but we want you to stay tuned because up next it's the Afternoon Magazine with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things. The host, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll talk about diet, nutrition, and exercise with registered dietitian Susan Kundrat. She joins us this afternoon at 1:06. Let's take a look now at what is happening on the Chicago Board of Trade and Mercantile Exchange. May wheat, 318, down 4.5. July, 327, down 6. May corn, 210.5, down 2.25. July, 219, down 2. September, 226, down